We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Today we have a very special guest. We're joined by none other than Jason Smith. Everybody's fan favorite on this Hornet squad. Jason, thanks very much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
First off, I guess we have to say congratulations for the win last night. That was perhaps one of the craziest games I've seen in a while.
Yeah, it was a big win for us. We've been struggling lately, but it was great to get a good win on the road, to end the road trip, to come back home. Definitely lifted our spirits up.
So, does it mean anything more to you when you get to play against old teammates like CP3? Does that make that win a little sweeter, or does it really not matter?
I think for the most part, for me, it makes it a little bit sweeter because I played with Chris. I mean, he's a tremendous player, tremendous competitor, and it's always fun to go out there and play against some of the best in the world. I mean, he is one of the best point guards, if not the best in my eye. That I've ever played with. It definitely makes it a little bit sweeter when you get a win against them.
So I've had an argument back and forth with my podcast compatriot, Michael McNamara. We would love to see you, of course, getting more than the 16 minutes a game that you're getting right now. But we're wondering, when you're out there, you hustle, you never take a playoff, you're always working as hard as you possibly can. Do you think that you would be able to do that if you were given 35 minutes a game, or would you actually have to change how you play?
You know, that's a great question, and a lot of people want me to get more minutes, but I think Coach and I definitely have a good understanding that the way that I play and the style of play that I play is definitely hard to do for a 30-minute span or a 35-minute span or even a 25-minute span, but it's one of those things where I just have to go out there, give it everything that I've got, leave it out there on the court, and Coach can really guesstimate where he wants me and how he wants me to play.
So we're not going to hear you throw Monty under the bus and demand more minutes on this podcast?
Never, never. Coach Williams and I definitely have a good understanding, and we're definitely on the same page. And I trust him completely. Over the years, he's definitely guided me in the right way, and I would never even think of him steering me in the wrong direction. He's a tremendous coach. Overall.
Yeah, it seems like Monty is, I don't think I've ever seen any player say anything bad about him, so I'm pretty happy that he's been brought on for a long-term period now. So I have one rather silly question for you. It seems like every single game there always ends up being a moment where you end up walking away from a scrum under the basket, blinking your eyes and rubbing your nose, or with a concussion last year, or somehow you always seem to manage to lead with your face. So I was wondering, have you ever thought of wearing a helmet when you play?
You know, that's kind of been the running joke with the trainers and I. for some reason, I always get hit in the face, whether it be in the lip or in the eye, or like you said, getting a concussion. And for some reason, I just we've joked about putting a helmet on me and just letting me go out there and play the way I play. But I just gotta keep being aggressive and take care of the bumps and bruises as they come.
So we spoke to Jerry V earlier this season during training camp, and he told us that you were working on your corner three and trying to add that to your game, but we've yet to see that at all. Is it true you're working on a corner three and trying to convince Monty to let you go at it, or are you focusing on other parts of your game, really, and that, because you haven't even taken one this year, as far as I know?
You know, I was working on that corner three a ton this summer and past summers before, but you know what? When we get a guy like Ryan Anderson who shoots the way that he shoots, I will gladly turn down any three opportunity that I have and give it to him, because he has been playing tremendous for us. I mean, we have so many people out there that can shoot: Roger Mason, Ryan Anderson, Austin Rivers, Gravis Vasquez has been shooting well lately. I mean, for me to take an attempt away from them, I feel like I'm shorting our team. So I really just want to go out there, play hard, and play smart.
Yeah, and since I'm, of course, clearly never been a player, so I have this is just one I like to ask shooters in general, because, I mean, your mid-range is money, and you've been hitting it better than you have in any season in the past as well. So the question I have is, you usually take your shot, you know, about 18 feet, and the three-point line is only, you know, two steps back, really, for you, maybe one step with your legs. So how much different is it taking that shot from just that one stride backwards from 18 feet? Is it purely a rhythm thing? Because you always get this idea of range in the NBA. That's outside of his range, but is really 5 feet a huge difference or not?
You know, it's really not too big of a difference. It just kind of changes the shot a little bit. You got to get your legs a little bit more into it. You have to take a little bit more time for some people. You really got to focus in because it's a longer distance. I mean, you wouldn't think it would be that hard, but until you try and go out there and do it, it's something completely different. And it's something that I really want to work on going forward, but for right now, I would never want to take away any of the shot selections from Roger Mason or Ryan Anderson. I mean, that's just not smart on my part to help our team out.
Yeah, Ryan's been absolutely amazing this year.
Lights out. I mean, he has been playing tremendous, and we really appreciate that from him. His work ethic and the way he plays and the type of teammate that he is just incredible.
So one of the issues that we've been seeing the most since the losing streak started, and of course it's ended now, but has been the Hornets have been on the receiving ends of some tremendous drubbings from three-point range. I mean, Oklahoma City did it to you, Phoenix hit it. So the question is, how long? I mean, this team is really young, and you know it takes a lot. A lot of these guys are in this defensive system for the first time. You've had the experience of coming in, being exposed to Monty Williams' system from the start. Typically, how long does it actually take before players start feeling comfortable in Monty's defensive scheme, and maybe we'll see a little bit less of these long range bombardments hitting our team?
You know, I think it's different for each player. I know for me, coming in my first year, I was definitely bombarded with the whole defensive scheme thing, because not too many teams or organizations or coaching staffs have the type of defensive strategy that we do. And for a young player and a young team, that can be hard. So it really varies between each player on how quickly they grasp each time. I think for us, we just have to continue to get better each day at it. For me, my first year, it was just repetition, going through it in games and practices and really getting better, showing improvement. And the coaches, they stay on top of us really to make sure that we get it right. They never want to steer us in the wrong direction. And they're always trying to help us, even though we may think that they're criticizing us for playing bad defense. But they really want us to get it down right, because those elite teams, the Miamis, the Oklahoma Cities, they do it. And when you see them do it, you think, well, if they can do it, we can do it too.
Right. And so defensively, I've heard Popovich say before that the key to a good defense is communication and having a guy in there who can just shout out where to go, coverages and things like that. On the Hornets team, who is the most vocal defensively about talking? Is there like a leader defensively, someone who, like, you know, you or Robin or someone who's down below who's calling out those assignments? Or is it really everybody has to kind of be aware and talking to each other?
You know, I think it's really everybody has to be aware.
Okay.
When the point guard's out there by himself playing defense on the top of the key, it's definitely hard to see a screen coming at him. So it's whoever's behind the defense really has to call out stuff, but it's a team thing. It's not one individual person. You have to communicate with all five players, and all five players have to be on a string. And it's really just going out there, like I said, communicating overall.
So when you came to the team, it had CP3, it had David West, and they'd been around the team for a long time. They were the team captains. They were clearly the leaders of that squad. And now you're the team captain. So what – I've just always kind of wondered, for the Hornets specifically, I know Monty's a really strong personality, but what does the team captain do for the team? Does he get just, like, the best towel and the coolest locker? Or does he have, like, responsibilities of you know, taking, like, Austin Rivers under his wing and making sure he's wearing his pink backpack?
No. I don't get the coolest locker or the best towel or anything like that. It's just a responsibility to go out there. And for me, it's to lead by example, to go out there, do your job, to prepare for practice, to take care of your body when you've got those bumps and bruises that kind of accumulate during the season. And really just to kind of portray to these young players that, hey, this is not a sprint of a season. This is a marathon. And a lot of the guys that we have on our team now, they played the 30-game college season where you play maybe once or twice a week. Well, now you have 3, 4, sometimes 5 games in a week. That can wear a person down. And really just to go out there, help them out in any way you can, whether it be on a defensive strategy or really having them be in tune in the game while they're on the bench or knowing their personnel that they're going against that night. It's just got to go out there and be a leader, and I think Coach trusts me that I've been in the system, that I know what I'm talking about, that I really just have to portray to the young guys, hey, this is what Coach expects from you, so let's get it in line and do what he expects.
So I'm going to hit you with a question. I usually get annoyed by reporters who ask these questions to people, but I'm going to do it anyways. I'm going to ask you to read in the mind of another one of your teammates. So Austin Rivers, he had a really large amount of hype about him at Duke. He actually draws a lot of traffic to our site still. He's just a big name. And he's come into the NBA, and he's meeting up with these athletes who are suddenly bigger, quicker, faster than anything he's experienced before. And he's struggling a bit out there. He had a really nice game last night. So what do you tell – A, does he seem like he's getting down at all by the beating he's taking? Because he's also having some rather unpleasant articles written about him sometimes in the national media. Does he seem like he's getting down? And what would you tell him if you know, you see him starting to maybe lose a little confidence?
You know, Austin Rivers is a competitor. He's very, very young. And you can kind of see that in his play overall. But I think he has a tremendous upside to him and that he never gives up. He's willing to fight in practice, in the games, and continue to fight. No matter what any media writes about him or newspapers or national media or anything, I think he knows that he's been in the spotlight. And he's handled it very well for how young he is. And I think going forward, he knows, and we know, coaches know, that as long as he continues to work hard and remain focused, he'll be okay in the long run.
So talking more about, like, when you were a rookie when you came in, and like you said before, it's now, you know, more than twice the number of games that you guys are that you're playing. When you're a young guy and you're coming in, does the team do a lot to try to steer you to, like, the right diet and the right habits? Or are they really kind of just letting you guys figure that out? How does that work?
You know, I think that it varies on each team. Obviously, I was drafted by Miami, then traded to Philly right away. Philly was definitely figure it out for yourself. And I think coming down here to New Orleans, it was a little bit different. It was figure it out by yourself, but also watch the older guys, watch the veterans. And I think as you learn and go forth in the NBA, you kind of figure out, well, you got to take care of your body because this is your money maker.
Right.
You have to take care of how you eat, get your rest at night, definitely take care of, I keep saying it over and over, take care of those bumps and bruises because they will accumulate as the season goes on. And I think that a lot of these young guys have really looked up to the older guys on the team and really watched what they do. But at the same point, we don't have a bad person on the team. We have a lot of people who are very professional and a lot of guys that are willing to work.
Right. And apparently, I mean, with Hakeem Warwick leaving, you're now the second oldest guy on the team, is it?
I don't know what you're talking about. I didn't hear that.
I mean, you've been with the team. I think it's just amazing that you've been with the team. This is your third season, and you're now the longest tenured Hornet. And for a while there, until they signed Roger Mason, I actually had an image made up for our blog that I was going to post that had you with, like, a Santa beard attached to it.
I hope not. I hope not. No, I really just want to go out there and continue to play hard. On a lot of other NBA rosters, I'd be a young guy. But on this roster, I'm happy to be kind of the wise, wily veteran.
Well, I mean, it's actually good because if you look at other models, like, you know, say the Thunder, they have a bunch of young guys, and they're all growing up and learning how to win together, and that's kind of what we're hoping will happen here in New Orleans.
True. I think it's one of those things where we want to get a young core of guys and really move forward with that team. You can look at a number of teams that have done it, obviously Oklahoma City, but also another team that a lot of people don't think of is Chicago. I mean, they've had a lot of young players, but they've played together for 4 or 5, almost 6 years now.
Right.
And they are that upper echelon. I think that's what we're geared towards, but at the end of the day, it all comes down to if you have great players and they're not willing to work, it could be a catastrophe, but I think we have great players that are willing to work, and coach
right.
knows that, and it's something that you very, very rarely find in the NBA.
So Michael had this question. So, and this, I hope you won't take this badly. When you first joined the team and you had, like, a phenomenal first month where you were drilling every mid-range shot you took, and then suddenly teams adapted and they were taking that away from you. And we used to talk about how you were an elite fifth big man on the team. Like, you couldn't find a better fifth big man on any team in the league other than Jason Smith. And over the course of 2 years, we've now we've changed to the point where we're like, yeah, we kind of like Jason Smith as a starter third big man on any team out there. And you've added a lot to your game, including, like, that you can now escape off of that mid-range shot. You can get to the basket a lot more. Is there a lot of coaching involved in the development of your game? Or did you do that, like, with your own trainer and just picked out things that you thought would help you? How does that development happen in the NBA? Because in our opinion, you've added quite a lot of weapons to your game over the past 2 years.
No, I completely agree with that. And it goes all towards coaching. I can't take any of the credit. I mean, I can go out there and work hard and everything, but I would have to say the coach that really helped me the most is James Borrego. He was with us the last 2 years, and now he's in Orlando. It was a sad day to see him go because he really helped me progress in my NBA career. It's one of those things you said, when I first got here, I was doing really well, and then after that, I don't know, month period, they really geared up to stop me. They realized that I was knocking down shots, so we really had to adjust and get better at maybe taking one dribble off of that pick and pop, or trying to get to the rim, or really adding in little things, like you said. And we've kind of just moved forward from that to progress and continue to work at those things. Well, if they know that I can shoot, well, let's work at the one dribble shot. Or they know I can do the one dribble shot, let's try and get all the way to the rim. And it's really just going forward from there. Just little pieces of my game that I try to work on every day. And we continue to do that. Brian Gates continues to do that with me, and Dave Hanners really helps me out as well. But just continuing to work hard and know that teams are going to try and take that mid-range shot away from me. I just have to keep them on their toes and not be just a one-dimensional player.
And as far as I can tell, you have the highest efficiency rating you've had since you came in the league. And honestly, the Hornets front court between you, Lopez, Anderson, and Anthony, when he can stay on the court, is actually grading out by most advanced measures as one of the best in the league. So here's hoping Eric Gordon comes back soon and you guys can start tearing up the place a little bit.
Yeah, we really have a good group of guys. And I think that if we continue to keep our heads down and focused and work hard, Coach is going to put us in the right direction. Coach Williams has definitely done a tremendous job, really just putting us in the right places. We have so many different players that can play such versatile positions. I think it's a testament that he has done such a good job with us so far.
So we had a question from a couple of our readers. They wanted to know if you had ever considered getting on Twitter. Or are you one of the guys who just you can't understand it? There's no reason why you want to do that.
You know, I really do understand Twitter, but I've never really gotten on to Twitter. I think I'm probably the only guy on the team that does not have Twitter.
Right.
So I've been enticed by a couple of my teammates to get on there, and there's definitely some cool perks about it of really giving back to the fans and staying in connection with the fans. But I just I've never really gotten around to it. I don't even know what to say about that one.
Well, I'm sure. Just let us know if you get on there so we can make sure we're not tricked by like the fake Jason Smith.
Yeah. Yeah.
They also wanted me to let you know that they love your hustle and great attitude, and we all appreciate how much you do with the city and with this team. And I personally, I will admit, I love Ryan Anderson's threes, but other than that, your gameplay is probably my favorite to watch on the entire team because you just never stop going, and that's great.
Thank you. Thank you. So, that's something that Coach and I really know that I have to continue to do, and whether it be for 5 minutes or 15 minutes or 20 minutes, I got to go out there and play hard every night.
25 minutes? 30? Yeah, so I'm going to make you, because I tried to do it earlier, but I'm going to make you throw Monty Williams under the bus about something. And you've probably been asked about this a million times. So, and it's kind of unfair that you're known around the league for this. Last year, when you leveled Blake Griffin, the next day, Monty was giving an interview. And he told reporters that you wouldn't crush a grape. So the question is Monty a liar, or would you crush grapes? And you would crush grapes if they needed to be? Or is he telling the truth?
He's telling the truth.
You wouldn't even crush grapes?
I'm not a hostile person. I love to go out there and compete. But when you catch me off the court,
so Mike,
I am probably
what did you think about
the goofiest
Jason
person ever.
Smith's answers to my questions.
Well, it's kind of upset that you didn't let me get a question in at all. Every time I tried to speak
from me.
You just coughed right over me.
All right, thanks very much for
didn't hear a word I said.
Rather lame question, yeah. Like that one. I do that all the time.
No, and all.
And
all
thanks for coming on our show. You know, it was great having you.
Schedule.
No problem.
I would have loved to have been on with them. I obviously helped with some of the questions. I think you did a great job in asking stuff that a lot of us want to know. I mean, the thing that stood out to me, there's a lot of things that really stood out to me, but the number one thing is, you know, he's an NBA player. He's fine in his own right. He had maybe his best game of the year, one of his best as a Hornet last night, and he just sounds in awe of Ryan Anderson.
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty funny listening to him. I was like, I feel the same way about Ryan Anderson. Guy's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of interesting things in there. I mean, I think a lot of things to be optimistic about. One, you know, Jason Smith really talking about how this Hornets defensive scheme is vastly different than what most teams in the NBA play. And when you have a system that has, I mean, it's like anything else. This system has a lot of upside to it, but it's going to take a lot more work to get there. You can't just plug and play different players, you know, but when it does start to click, because you put in all that time, it's going to be an elite defense. But right now, with guys who are just, you know, getting a grasp of it, or maybe playing out of position or playing more minutes than they should, whatever, you know, the Hornets are struggling right now. And Jason Smith clearly said that, you know, it's going to take time, but they have the right attitude guys on this team and guys who are willing to put in the work.
Yeah, that's not surprising that he's going to be very complimentary of his players. And I tried to get him to throw Monty under the bus. He wouldn't do it.
I mean, there's nothing to throw him under the bus about. But I don't know. I felt like he was very sincere, and I think this has been, you know, a part of the organizational attitude is bringing in the right guys and guys who want to be here. And, you know, it sounds to me that, I mean, Jason Smith is an incredibly talented player. He's getting better every year. And he just seems so humble. I mean, the fact that he seems okay with, you know, with even playing 5 minutes if that's what Monty thinks is best for the team. I mean, I just don't know how you can't come out of that interview even more in love with the guy than you were going into it.
Yeah. I will say this. If I was an NBA prospect, I don't know if I'd want to be drafted by Philly.
Yeah. He was very nice to say that organizations did things, quote unquote, differently.
Right. He's traded to Philadelphia, and they kind of just let you figure it out on your own.
Yeah.
Although you'd notice he did say about the Hornets that, you know, they were still letting you figure it out on your own, but there was maybe a little bit more help there. So.
And what did you get from his answer on Austin Rivers? Because, again, I find that incredibly sincere that, you know, the guy is just, and not the first person we heard it from, but, you know, he has his flaws, no doubt, but is a competitor that's just going to keep going hard until he gets it right.
Well, that's what you want to hear. I mean, if a guy's struggling and he needs to work on something, that's exactly what you're hoping, is that you find out that he's a hard worker, that he keeps trying, that he won't give up. And that's what's gonna turn you into a useful player, just like he said. That's why he got better, was he kept working and he listened to his coaches and he got better, and now he's a lot more skilled than he was. I said it in the thing, I don't normally like it when people ask questions about other players on the team, because reading the mind is kind of silly. But I mean, do you know why I asked that? When you were watching the Clippers game, were you watching the Clippers broadcast or the Hornets broadcast?
Unfortunately, I was watching the Clippers broadcast.
Did you hear what they were saying about Austin Rivers in that?
Which time? Because they were...
When they were quoting the unnamed, unspecified internet post that said that Austin Rivers had no discernible NBA talent at all.
Yeah, and then when he started hitting threes, they said, "Well, that's an NBA talent." Yeah.
But they were laughing about it, like this is a big joke that he can actually hit these threes.
Yeah, that entire broadcast was embarrassing.
It bothered me.
I mean, to go back to Jason Smith, is doing nothing wrong. He gets hit with a, you know, an elbow to the face of Matt Barnes. The right. Clippers commentators immediately, you know, put the blame on Jason Smith, how he's always in the middle of something.
Right.
He's standing there and he gets hit with an elbow to his temple. I mean, it was just that broadcast team was, you know, I make fun of Sean Elliott for being a homer, but he's right. not just, you know, blatantly vicious to, you know, other teams. He just praises his guys. That broadcast team was completely unprofessional and just embarrassing.
Well, I mean, and they did it earlier, too, when, like, Jason Smith happens to be guarding Blake Griffin on a breakaway. Suddenly it's like, oh, me, oh, my, it's going to be another one of those. Oh, we got to flash back and show it. It's like, come on.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the guys.
Is that a good impression? Me, oh, my.
Who were the guys that we considered, or Hornets fans considered, dirty when Chris Paul was on this team? I mean, I know there had to be a couple. The only one that really sticks out to me is Dante Jones. I don't remember why. Didn't he kick?
I mean, obviously Bruce Bowen.
Right.
I don't know. I always thought Kenyon Martin was pretty dirty.
Yeah, but I'm trying to give Clippers fans and announcers the benefit of the doubt. I mean, that's their, you know, superstar player. It was a tough foul. And again, Jason Smith isn't known, unfortunately, by a good player. I'm still shocked that when Jason Smith has a night like he did last night, other teams' announcers are surprised. I mean, this is a guy who's steadily been getting better, and you would think by now he had been through the league enough to where pretty much every team's announcers and fan base would know that this is a quality NBA player, but he's still, you know, known to non-Hornets fans and followers as for this one act, and I think it's ridiculous. I don't know. It was hard to watch that game with the Clippers announcers last night.
Right, and they were saying the same thing. I mean, they were talking about Ryan Anderson, and they're like, oh, well, if you throw the ball to Blake Griffin, there's no way Ryan Anderson has a chance of defending him. So maybe they should have looked at the box score, because it looked like Ryan Anderson did a fine job on Blake Griffin in that game.
So, I mean, just before we move on, I mean, this is the 100th.
Bitter thing. It's good stuff.
Yeah, this is the 100th podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, it's such an exciting guest to get for it. It seems like it's been forever. I can't believe we're on our 100th already, but anything else coming out of that interview with Jason Smith, any nuggets that you know, just picked up on or stick with you? What's the, I guess, what was just your general sense coming out of that interview?
Well, I had gotten kind of the impression before that James Borrego was a really well-loved assistant coach. But, I mean, it's a shame he's in Orlando, because Jason Smith, I mean, he basically just said Borrego is the reason why he is who he is, that he developed him and helped him turn into a good NBA player. So, I mean, I always wonder, at, you know, how much coaching actually has to do with player development, because, you know, players have that whole summer, and that's when they really start getting better. If they don't have any involvement with those coaches, why do the coaches get credit for it? But, you know, there are definitely situations like this where the player's just like, yeah, that guy's the one who put me on the right path. So it's a little bit of a shame that he's not there, though he did say that Brian Gates is helping him now, too. So.
Yeah, that and what I love about Jason Smith, and I think that is rare, I think one of the attributes that goes overlooked in NBA players that's my favorite is whether a guy plays within himself or not. And you heard Jason Smith time and time in that interview. I mean, he said that he trusted Monty. You know, he's going to go full out because that's what Monty thinks is best. And, you know, this is the kind of game he wants him to play. And if you really think about it, you know, this is a guy who is, you know, following a coach word for word saying, I need you to play like this for us to win, who had 20 wins last year. You know what I mean? And I mean, it would be so easy to turn around and say, you don't know what you're talking about, or we're not winning anyway. I'm just going to go get mine because my contract is coming up soon. But, you know, Jason Smith obviously agrees with the game plan of Monty. I mean, guys usually want more minutes and shots. He just wants to play within himself and do what's best to help the team win. I mean, even his philosophy of, I'm not going to take threes because I'm going to be taking them away from guys who are always going to be better three-point shooters than me. I mean, it's just, you know, it's the type of thing that a coach would just absolutely love to have every player have that mentality. And you could see why. I mean, I know we've floated ideas because we have so many big men of, you know, why not trade one of these big men in a package for a guard? But after that interview and just thinking about how much he means to this team and how he buys in and really epitomizes what this team is about, like, I would have to get twice to three times his actual on-court value in return to trade that guy.
He's bought his way into your heart with an interview?
I mean, it was just, guys could be taught to say the right thing.
Right.
But that's not the type of thing that a PR or a publicist person teaches a guy to say. They teach you what not to say. They teach you how to say the cliches. Like, that is obviously the real philosophy of Jason Smith. And there's, what do we say, 450 players in the NBA? I would guarantee that no more than 20 of them are as selfless, you know, as Jason Smith.
Yeah. No, I mean, I agree. It makes you not envy Dell Demps having to make those kind of decisions. Because, I mean, if he gets a deal and Jason Smith has to be part of it, that would be pretty rough. Because, I mean, is there a more likable guy?
No. And again, not a guy that I think that, you know, Ryan Anderson is uber talented. Anthony Davis, you know, has the sky is the limit for his game. But as far as the philosophy of this team, I don't think that the Hornets could possibly have a better guy, you know, to epitomize, you know, what Dell and Monty want in a player. I mean, I don't know. I was blown away by that and his mentality and his, you know, selflessness. And, it was great to see him have such a good game against the Clippers and Blake. I mean, that was only one win, and it, you know, it was a seven-game losing streak going into that?
Yeah.
That one win almost, you know, single-handedly made up for all those losses. That was just a magnificent win. It was so late last night, but I couldn't go to sleep for a couple hours afterwards. I mean, it felt like more than just one win out of 82 games.
Yeah. It was one of those, just one of those games where you were unbelievably excited. I mean, I was actually cackling out loud at some of the shots we were hitting. And then I was screaming at the TV about some of the shots we were letting them take. I mean, it was an incredibly fun game, but it was also, while incredibly satisfying, it was also incredibly frustrating. I mean, so I typically give Aminu a pass because his help defense is so good, but holy crap. I mean, Caron Butler now is drilling you that hard from three, and you're going to let him get open again and again and again in yet another game? At some point, I mean, stop doubling people. Stay put.
I mean, it was almost identical. I mean, all these three-point barrages have felt different. I mean, against Houston, it was a lot of drive and kick. You know, the Phoenix one, it was just it was just a different feeling. This one felt exactly like Paul George in the Indiana game. The way that Aminu would just leave Butler, you know, for guys who weren't threats or not finding him. I mean, did you see the one where they passed it to Butler and Aminu actually turned the wrong way? before he finally, you know, found Butler, who was right behind. I mean, it was bad, and I just don't know. I mean, you see once Ryan Anderson hits two, you know, guys absolutely stick to him and transition and, you know, don't allow him to become the guy that's open on the rotation. But, you know, it was very frustrating to watch Aminu, and there were just flashbacks of that Paul George game.
Yeah. So, said Ryan Anderson, I don't think I have ever seen a guy more able to take step backs behind the three-point line and drill them. I mean, like Jason was saying in that thing, it's a different type of shot when you're shooting from three. You have to get your legs into it to get the, you know, the force needed. Ryan Anderson, like, holy cow. I mean, how can he do that? He's going backwards, and he still has enough ability to just, I mean, they're not even, like, bouncing around and going in. They just hit rim straight down.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, he was fantastic, and this is, I mean, Jason Smith was in awe, and he, you know, he deserves to be. So I'll just run you through a couple of offensive stats. So obviously we know that last year Ryan Anderson led the league in both field goal and three-point attempts and in three-pointers made. He's on pace to absolutely crush that, both categories, this season. He's actually on pace to set the all-time single-season mark for three-pointers made. He's in the top 10 of offensive rating amongst all players in the NBA. And this isn't a fluke. This is actually the third year in a row he's in the top 10 in offensive rating. He was actually number 4 in the league last year. The last one that really, I guess, impressed me, his effective field goal percentage is over 60%, which is fourth in the entire league, while his turnover percentage is only 6%, which is sixth best in the league. So I just rattled off a couple of major categories in which Ryan Anderson is in the top 10, and in most of those that I rattled up, he's in the top 5 in the entire NBA amongst offensive players. Just it's an absolutely amazing season.
And how much is he being paid?
Yeah, about $8.5 million. I still can't understand the Magic's logic. I can't, because people will tell me, well, they didn't want to bring him back because they want to tank this year. Why did you pay? Why did they pay Jameer Nelson then?
Right.
Like, they essentially chose Jameer Nelson as their, you know, quasi young veteran, you know, whatever, over Ryan Anderson. I mean, Jameer Nelson,
he's what, 29?
Yeah, and he makes more this year and next year than Ryan Anderson. They basically, in choosing between the two, chose Jameer Nelson. It still absolutely blows my mind. At the very least, sign Ryan Anderson and then look to trade him. I don't get it, because they're not playing Gustavo Ayon. Like, he's just not getting minutes. It baffles me how in the world the Magic made that deal. I absolutely don't get it. But so glad that we could be on this end of a stupid GM decision.
Right. Yeah, well, it's nice. Someone brought it up in the comments, and I should have paid attention to their name. I'm sorry if you're listening to this. When Ryan tracked down that offensive rebound in the corner,
right,
and Chris Paul was guarding him, and Ryan turned around and saw him there, it was absolutely, I mean, dead on. Paul was clearly not expecting him to shoot whatsoever. I mean, why would you? The guy is like, he just tracked down an offensive rebound. He's got 24 seconds. He's kind of off balance. He's turning around, and just one step, ball's gone. And Paul clearly had no idea what was going on. That was a that was the moment where I just cackled.
Yeah, and that's a thing that I like about Ryan Anderson is it seems to me, because in that game he started off slow. I think he started off 1-for-4 from three, and then he made 4 of his last 5. But he doesn't have any conscience, they tell you as a quarterback, if you throw an interception, forget about it the second afterwards and, you know, go back and play your game. If that's in the back of your head, you're going to be affected. And Ryan Anderson, that's what I love about him. He could be cold, but if he has an open look or he has a guy 10 inches shorter than him on him and he could get up his shot, he knows it's an incredibly efficient shot. He knows he's one of the best shooters in the world at that shot, and he takes it because that is the right move, regardless of if he had made his last two or he missed his last two. If the guy has an open look and it's the right shot to take in the flow of the offense, he's going to take it. And you just see too many players who, you know, have missed a shot or they just got their last shot blocked or they just had a turnover, who are so afraid to make 2 or 3 bad plays in a row and get pulled. And Ryan Anderson just doesn't feel that way. He takes the shot if it's the right shot to take, regardless of whether he's made or missed his last couple. And in that situation, with a 6-foot guard on you and you're able to get up the most efficient shot in basketball, the corner three, he took it. And it was just, another thing that, I mean, I'm just so glad he's repaying us for us gushing so much about him
right
in the off season, because we would have looked like fools if we held this guy up high and he came in and struggled early.
So we have to bring up Grievous Vasquez from that game. I mean, we talk about him after every podcast. I mean, is there a better example game than that one where you get to see the lows and the highs of Grievous Vasquez as a basketball player? Because he was brilliant shooting. He was aggressive. He took big shots. He was passing really well. And he was turning the ball over, completely failing at times to get the ball into attack position. Chris Paul with just, you know, crossovers and step backs was, you know, unstoppable. Vasquez couldn't do anything to slow him down even slightly. I don't even know how you properly evaluate Vasquez's value anymore, because he comes up with these huge games and these huge numbers, but you know he's causing all these problems and causing all these issues at the same time. I mean, what do you do with that?
I know, because so I had somebody who did this in golf that I used to play with. They never actually kept their score. What they did was they tracked their good shots and their bad shots. That's it. So my drive was good in on that hole. He would put a check mark for good there. He would hit a good approach shot, then a bad putt and a good putt. So he would just score that hole. 3 good, 1 bad. You know, obviously, I guess he kind of knows his shots if he adds up the check marks, but that's what he was looking at, just merely good and bad shots. If you were to do that for every Hornets player and merely track them by that was a good play by you and then that was a bad play by you, Grievous Vasquez would lead this team both in good plays and bad plays. And I've never, ever seen that in an NBA player in my life. That is nearly impossible. But I think you would say, if you went back and looked at that game and did exactly what I'm saying, don't you agree that he would lead the team in good plays and in bad plays?
Absolutely. And probably the team in smack talk, because he was there's some guy on the sidelines that he was just, every time he had a shot, he said something to the sidelines.
So
it was awesome. He was having a good time with somebody.
Yeah, and it rubbed up on Austin, because Austin did it later in the game after a big three. But let me ask you this. So in the post-game interview, Chris Paul, and I wish I had seen it, because all I have is the words and I don't know the context, but Chris Paul essentially said, let me find a nice way to put this. We lost tonight to a less than talented team, but a team with great coaching. And then he goes on to say, Greivas Vasquez played a great game tonight. He's on the way to making his first All-Star team. Essentially, those are the words he said. Do you, because it's about 50-50 in Hornets fans, how they're taking that. Do you think he sincerely meant that, or do you think he's being sarcastic with the quote?
With Paul, I don't think he's ever actually sarcastic when he's complimenting another player, honestly. I genuinely think that Paul, when he makes comments about people, about how good they are, he generally feels that way about them. Now, I would be willing to bet that if you got him in a conversation like 5 days from then, and when it's not fresh in his mind, and you ask him seriously, do you think Greivas Vasquez is going to be an All-Star, his answer would be different. But it would still be, well, Vasquez is a great player. I just don't attribute, because of what I've seen and heard from Paul, I don't attribute like a nasty edge to comments like that that come from him.
Yeah, I mean, but you are right. I mean, as far as offensively, we know Chris Paul's game. He kind of gets other people involved in the first half, and then he'll start taking over in the third quarter, and then really start taking over in the fourth. There was a minute in the, you know, he came back in the game in the second quarter after being on the bench for a while, where it looked like somebody whispered to him, you know, Greivas Vasquez is covering you, right? And Chris Paul just finally realized it in that quarter and just, you know, was able to get wherever he wanted and scored at will. I'm sure, you know, Chris Paul is licking his chops when he sees Greivas Vasquez on the schedule, but you know, Vasquez, and this is something that I've been watching for since you pointed it out, they were, a lot of Rhino's three-pointers were down screens from Vasquez. And Vasquez's height advantage over Paul allowed him to pull up on some jumpers and shoot right over him. And that size that he has, you know, allowed him to send down screens for Ryan Anderson to free him for threes. Yep. And I mean, there are a lot of things that are invaluable about Greivas Vasquez that, as frustrating as the 8 turnovers is, and Monty Williams, you know, came out and said Vasquez had a double-double tonight, almost had a triple-double with the turnovers, even he spoke about it. That, I mean, there's just, it's a guy that you want so bad to root for, and you want him to remove his flaws, but I'm pretty sure they'll always be there.
Yeah. But again, if you could team him with the appropriate backcourt, I think that he could be easily a very, very good guard in the three-guard rotation. And that could be starting, that could be the backup. So
yeah.
So we need to move to the next guard, because you meant Austin Rivers. Best game of the season, no question, correct?
Yeah. I mean, if he hit his free throws, this would be a phenomenal game.
Right. And I think we said that last time he got, you know, 14 points was, if he'd been done better than 2 of 7, he would have been even greater. So, I mean, but it was more than just the fact that he was actually making shots, because he was drilling those threes, and I mean, everybody was drilling the threes. He was actually handling the pressure from Paul and Bledsoe extremely well on that game. And as soon as he came on the court and started playing, bringing the ball up, I mean, you could tell that the Clippers were just, like, salivating. They're like, oh, we're going to just pick him clean and make his life miserable. And it didn't happen. I mean, he wasn't flawless, but he did a really good job handling that. He ended up with only one turnover in the end. So, I mean, kudos to the guy. And if he can continue to – I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And I never thought I would actually say this. I mean, he is a point guard.
Yeah, I don't think, I mean, I don't know why we're surprised, but I mean, I guess he was listed as a shooting, I don't know, but his skill set.
I'm surprised by that because if you look at any of his assist numbers to turnover numbers to the kind of assists he got, what he was getting at Duke did not indicate passing shooting guard, much less point guard.
And I hate to make excuses for him, and I made it then, and it's not an excuse to me, it's just what I watched when they played. That was a really bad Duke team, and he was asked to do, I mean, he was really the only guy who could create his own shot. And, you know, in a lot of ways he was asked to do that. But, yeah, I mean, he was – I mean, his handle and his first step in this game, I mean, I know Jordan Crawford isn't the best defender in the world, but for a lot of that game, Matt Barnes was on him. And he got by Matt Barnes with ease. I absolutely love that. I agree with, you know, him handling the ball. I mean, Brian Roberts only played 11 minutes and he had two turnovers, you know, to Austin's one. Obviously Vasquez with the eight turnovers. So it was huge that a guy handling the ball that much, you know, was able to keep away from the turnovers. I remember one play late in the game where he got trapped and had to use a timeout, but again, smart play by the rookie. But yeah, I mean, I think we've seen what his offensive game is going to be in his rookie year. You got the occasional three. He went 3 for 4 on this night, got some open looks. The one he missed was, you know, a 30 footer at the end of the shot clock. And then he's got that, you know, drive to the bucket when he's on the right side. He uses the glass with the floater, you know, otherwise coming in center, he just, you know, goes straight in with it. But I mean, that's pretty much his game. I don't expect to see a mid-range game this year or, you know, pull-ups off the pick and roll.
He did pull up once in that game, though.
Yeah.
I was shocked. I mean, I was shocked. I mean, he missed.
Yeah, I still don't think that's going to be him, but I really think he could continue attacking and get better finishing at the rim and then the occasional three, but I really see him as a distributor. I mean, there was one pass he made where he blew by his guy and there was help defense, and it looked like the obvious pass was to one player. I don't remember who it is, but he actually, you know, made a skip pass to Ryan Anderson for an open three that was just phenomenal. I mean, he had 6 assists in this game. 4 of those were for 3-pointers. So you're talking about his 6 assists leading to 16 points. So 14 points scoring, 6 assists leading to 16 points. He basically, you know, contributed 30 points in this game, played solid enough defense, kept the turnovers, you know, at a minimum. You wish he would make those free throws, but, I mean, I just think an absolutely fabulous game, and I'm happy for him. And I think we know now once and for all, the Schwann jinx does work.
All right. It might take a little bit. And, I mean, Brian Roberts, I'll say this. If I was looking at him as Pargo for our team, I would be fine with him. I mean, he's playing fairly well.
Yeah, and I mean, what's frustrating to me is that in that second quarter, actually it was the end of the first quarter, Rivers and him come in for the final 3 minutes, and Rivers is handling the ball, and essentially Brian Roberts is playing the two in that situation. Rivers actually got him a beautiful wing three-pointer look that Roberts drained, and I mean, to me, if and when Eric Gordon comes back, I love that backup, you know, backcourt of Rivers and Roberts. I think we could throw Henry away. We could, you know, use Mason sparingly. Give me those two as the main two backups, but let Rivers be the one that initiates and sets up the offense, and Roberts play off the ball, because it looks to me like 18 to 23 feet outside of Ryan Anderson, he might be the best just pure shooter that we have.
Yeah. So turning to their team really quick, there's 2 things I wanted to say about them. Willie Green was lighting us up. I don't know why he didn't get back on the court again, because he was torching us for his 18 minutes. And then B, DeAndre Jordan, you've got to be kidding me. You're going to post him up as your primary option, like 3 of your first 5 possessions, you're going to go to a post-up from DeAndre Jordan. I mean, those were some of the roughest post moves I've ever seen in my life. And I watched Tyson Chandler when he first arrived with the Hornets and didn't know, you know, what a post was.
Yeah, and I mean, I had told you off the air, because you were asking me, I think it was a week or two ago, if DeAndre Jordan was really improving, and I've seen almost all the Clippers games this year, and he really was. I mean, I think it was just such a shock, and it wasn't on the scouting reports yet, or teams were happy to give him that, but I mean, this is a guy who coming into that game was averaging almost 15 a game, you know, shooting 60%. And he's not scoring points from the line. So, that's per 36 minutes, 15 a game. He's averaging a little over 10. It is 25 minutes, but I mean, still, he did show that earlier in the season. And I was kind of surprised by how bad he looked.
Yeah, I mean, I was expecting to see something new there, and if anything, I was just like, wow, I wouldn't pay that guy to be on my team, much less $10 million a year. So
yeah,
I don't know. And then, I mean, put him with Blake Griffin in that game. I mean, if Caron Butler hadn't been going absolutely, and actually I shouldn't say that because you know. They went 18-37 from three, which is crazy, and it was much better than that even before they missed all those three-pointers at the end of the game. But, I mean, we did go 15-25 from three, and that's just not going to happen very often.
Yeah.
So, I mean, Grievous Vasquez, 5-8. Anderson, 5-9. Austin Rivers, 3-4. Brian Roberts was 1-3. Just...
Yeah, I would love to know how many times... It's happened where a team has made 18 or more three-pointers and lost.
I bet I could find that out pretty quickly. That's basketballreference.com has a plethora of data for you.
But yeah, I mean, to the Willie Green point, I mean, I think with how well he's playing all year, you kind of have to get Crawford his minutes, even if he's not playing as well as Willie Green, and for the Clippers on that night, that was a shame because you're right. You know, Willie Green was just finding open spots in the corner in this defense, which we know could be exploited. He hit two out of his three threes. He had, you know, 10 points on just six shots in 17 minutes, and we didn't really see anything from him. The guy that, to me, has just fallen off the planet is we just watched this game last night. Do you remember anything Lamar Odom did? You could have told me he didn't play last night, and I would go, I believe. I mean, I watched every second of this game. I don't remember one play that Lamar Odom had any impact whatsoever.
Well, no. I mean, I disagree. I remember Lamar Odom very well because he was whining at the refs all game because of stupid off-the-ball fouls. But if you mean, like, actual basketball play where he, you know, shot or passed or rebounded? No, he did nothing.
I mean, that's remarkable to me. This is a sixth man of the war of the year winner from just over, I mean, a little over two seasons ago. He was on a championship team, an integral part, probably either their second or third best player, sixth man of the year, and now this guy, I mean, I don't remember. I remember Ryan Hollins making plays. I do not remember anything about Lamar Odom. It's just fascinating to me how far he's fallen.
Yeah. So I have your answer for you. There have been 7 teams that have made 18 three-pointers in a game and lost. Two of them were in double overtime games. So those don't really count. But the other teams were the Golden State Warriors versus Memphis back in 2007. They hit 18 of 46. They took 46 three-pointers and lost that game 135-144. The worst one, and this one's kind of shocking, back in January 27th of 2012, so it was this year, New York versus Miami, and New York hit 18 of 43 threes and lost by 89-99. So they actually hit 18 threes and only scored 89 points.
Yeah, wow. I'm trying to think when D'Antoni was let go, if that was still a D'Antoni coach team, but so it's pretty rare. I mean,
yeah, it is pretty rare. I mean, this is 50 years worth of data.
So. At one point, the Clippers were 18 of 32. Mm-hmm. They missed their last five. They missed four in that barrage and one before that. I mean, they weren't just shooting the shoot. They were shooting it at an incredibly high rate and still lost this game. So,
yeah.
But, I mean, to me, the Hornets balanced it out. Yeah, they drained the threes, but one of my keys to the game going in, because the Clippers fouled so much, was getting to the line. And of the 23 free throw attempts, it feels like 15 of them came off, you know, some sort of technical foul. But still, the Hornets got to the line nonetheless.
Yeah, I forgot to ask Jason what he thought about his 5-point play.
Yeah, I mean, that was funny. Mason tweeted out when that happened, or after the game, that Jason Smith scored more essentially on one possession over the course of, I think it was 11 seconds, than Blake Griffin did all game.
Oh, that's actually pretty funny.
Yeah, fantastic.
Griffin got, I mean, that was just a crushing game for him. 4 points, 6 rebounds, 3 assists, 1 steal, 4 turnovers, and 6 fouls.
And
1 of 9.
And then again, I mean, Blake comes out afterwards and says that he just doesn't like Jason Smith, that essentially, you know, the difference between playing hard and playing dirty. Give me a break. I mean, to me, I'm just being purely objective on this, not a homer. We have seen Jason Smith for multiple years now. Nobody else has had a problem with him. Where Blake Griffin has, you know, in his short time in the NBA, has had run-ins with multiple players. To me, that tells me, of those two guys, which one, you know, is at fault in this situation.
I think, other than Ryan Anderson drilling that three in Chris Paul's face, I thought the funniest moment in the entire game was when they kicked the ball to Blake Griffin at, you know, about where Jason Smith takes his pick-and-pop shot. And he sets his feet really carefully, and he slowly squares his shoulders, and he gets ready to take that shot, and Jason Smith starts to run out of him and checks himself, kind of shrugs, and ran back under the basket to guard the to help guard the guy who's going to be rebounding. And Blake Griffin took the shot, wide open, nobody around, rebound Hornets. I mean, it was just like, yeah, go ahead and take that shot, please, because you're not making it.
So let me ask you this, because you and I, we've done 100 podcasts now. We're going to make mistakes in retrospect. We don't always have the ability to play Monday morning quarterback. You have said two statements in past podcasts. I will give you time now because this is the 100 threshold. Once you go over this threshold, no taking it back. One, when we talked about Anthony Davis before he got drafted and – you know, whether or not you would take him over X players in the league, you and I, you know, disagreed on most. I wasn't taking him over anybody except for maybe Dwight. You put Kevin Love and Blake Griffin in there. Do you want to take that back? Is there any chance that for the present and the future, you are taking Blake over Anthony Davis?
Well, I mean, it all depends on, I mean, so I'm going to qualify this because Blake Griffin this season has been pretty bad. I mean, he's averaging, like, 16 points a game. I mean, he's nowhere near what he was last year. If he returns to, I mean, if he was playing the way he played last year, I would still consider it. I mean, Blake Griffin is an amazing basketball player when he's on. But, I mean, this year he's just completely fallen apart, and I don't know what's causing it. Doesn't he have, like, some sort of injury with his foot? That he plantar fasciitis or something like that.
Yeah, he's injured and he's coming back from it, but okay.
Right, but I mean, so it would be a very difficult thing for me to just dismiss Blake Griffin. But if we take into account salaries, no, I would not make any trade for Blake Griffin.
And same question with Ryan Anderson. I mean, even throwing salaries out of the equation, because I know that makes it pretty clear which one you would take. But if you're just an NBA GM and you're trying to win basketball games, you could have either one of those guys. Which one are you taking? No marketability, just on court.
Just on court. So is it last year's Blake Griffin or this year's Blake Griffin?
I mean, I don't know how you could. I mean, right. He is who he is.
I would probably take Blake Griffin.
All right, guys. I gave him a chance, and he still didn't take it. He's stubborn as usual.
I don't like Blake Griffin. Now, I enjoy watching Ryan Anderson play basketball more than I probably would enjoy watching Blake Griffin play basketball. But I think Blake Griffin may have a bigger impact overall. I mean,
I just don't see how he ends.
He doesn't score quite as efficiently, but he's a better rebounder. He's a better assister. So, and he has the potential to be a defensive monster if he ever puts his brain
come on.
He does the potential.
And why doesn't Ryan Anderson? I mean, neither one is ever going to.
Because Ryan Anderson doesn't have the athletic gifts that Blake Griffin does. Ryan Anderson's not going to be jumping out of the gym blocking shots. I'm not saying Griffin does. I'm saying Griffin has more of a potential to be able to be that.
But that's not all that comes with being a good defender. It comes about, you know, it comes from, you know, your willingness to put in the effort and the basketball IQ, of which I would give both to Ryan Anderson. So to me, again, they both have potential to be great defenders. I don't think either will be. I mean, to me, so you're saying what if it was last year's Blake Griffin, then it would be hard. Why is it hard? Because last year's Blake Griffin was such a bad free throw shooter, so poor at the end of games, such a non-threat, you know, from 16 feet and out, that Reggie Evans and Kenyon Martin, one guy on a minimum contract, the other guy not in the league this year, played minutes in the playoffs at the end of games over this guy that, according to you, was...
Oh, you're completely exaggerating that.
What did I exaggerate about?
He played big minutes in the playoffs.
I don't know if you watch. Go watch the end of the... of any of the Memphis games. The Spurs game, the Spurs series was over so quick that, you know, we didn't even really get to see. But in the Memphis games, at the end of games, Reggie Evans and Kenyon Martin are closing out every single one of those games. That would if Blake Griffin is legitimately a top 30 player or a real all-star, that would never, ever happen to a real all-star.
So now you're saying Blake Griffin isn't even an all-star?
Not at all. He's a high.
Wow.
He's a highlight reel. He's a hype machine. If I'm a coach, nothing at all scares me about him as far as having to figure out how to defend him. Versus Ryan Anderson is an absolute nightmare to game plan for. It's not even close. To me, he's a name. He's a highlight reel. There's absolutely nothing about his game that scares me. I think maybe he could be a third option on a really good team. I can't see him as a first or second scoring option on a team that's legitimately going to win anything. I mean, the Clippers are winning this year. Blake Griffin is their third op. I mean, that's who he is. There's no way you could convince me he's even close to Ryan Anderson. I don't care about salaries. So,
wow. Okay.
That's my Blake. I don't know. It was just an absolutely fantastic game. We didn't even talk about some of the guys who probably deserve some mentioning in the game, but it was just such a good win. I mean, just really got the goodwill back of Hornets fans after a couple of tough losses. And I think the question, the thing that we didn't address, we wondered about it going in. Eric Gordon did show up. He did sit on the bench. We got some really weird quotes from both Monty and Eric. Eric had some weird quotes where he called his knee a disorder. Like, I don't know. I mean, he seems to just have these words that pop out. The caliber of player he was in the offseason, now he's talking about his knee's disorder. Just really weird. But to me, what struck me as the weirdest was Monty saying that, you know, it was good to catch up with Eric. Now, I remember Monty and Dell and, you know, from things that we've heard of other people, I mean, they were in constant conversation, and even David West and Chris Paul said it after they left, that they were in constant conversation with Dell and Monty, you know, towards the end and in that year once Dell took over. Does it just seem weird to you that this guy who is our star, our best player, yada, 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 it seems like nobody ever talks to this guy? I mean, was it weird to you at all when you heard that Monty had caught up with Eric just yesterday?
No, because I think, yes, it's weird, but I don't think that there is anything about the Eric Gordon situation that doesn't just completely flabbergast me. I don't understand what's either he is completely full of it, which flabbergasts me. I don't understand that. I mean, I can't understand somebody who would be that talented who's just throwing it all away, even if he is looking for a trade. And B, if he's not, if he's actually injured, then I don't understand everything else that's going on, because they don't really seem interested in talking to him or being around him, and they want him off in L.A. doing this. I mean, everything about this is just bizarre.
Yeah, I mean, if Chris Paul was injured in rehab, do you really think that Monty wouldn't have talked to him for 4 weeks?
No, I mean, but who knows if that's true? I mean, that's the whole thing is Monty said it was good to catch up with him, so I don't know. Maybe Gordon's not answering his calls.
His exact quote: "I've talked to him already, just reacquainting and talking about rehabs and things of that nature. He said it's going really well. He was pretty upbeat about it." So yeah, I mean, he's just reacquainting, talking to. Yeah, I just figured I'd talk to my superstar who, you know, has been out for 4 weeks and just see. And he seems to be going well. And then Gordon's quote was, "It's almost like a disorder. There was a little bit of a bone bruise, and, you know, kind of like some of these other guys, like Bynum and Granger. Ugh. Luckily, my process will be shorter than that." I mean, how does he know if none of this shows up anywhere and, you know, it's a disorder of the knee? It's so weird. It was good to see him on the bench. He tweeted out how excited he was after the game. As multiple people said, if Eric Gordon isn't excited about this team and coming back after watching a shorthanded version of this team beat a very good Clippers team on the road, you know, I don't know what would get him excited, but it's every time you start to maybe get optimistic and excited about this guy and this return, and wow, how good would this team be if they were fully healthy? Just some of these quotes are just so weird. And it's almost like an episode of Lost. Like, you go in with 20 questions and you might get two of them answered, but then you get four more at the end of the episode.
Really? You're comparing this to Lost?
I love Lost. I think that the final season got bashed unfairly, and I guess that's my new campaign to make people love Lost again. But no, that's just what it reminds me of. That was the complaint of Lost. I had a bunch of questions, a couple got answered, now I have 10 more, and that's what I feel like every single time there's any interaction whatsoever with Eric Gordon.
Honestly, I think the Lost comparison actually works for me too, because for me, my wife loved Lost. I would watch Lost for about 8-9 shows in a row, like just off of discs, watch them. And by about the 9th show, I felt like I was being manipulated and completely lied to so badly that I was just kind of angry, and I stopped watching until I kind of forgot about it, and then thought, well, hey, that was a good show, and I would go back and watch it again, and then I'd repeat the process. So I guess Eric Gordon's the same sort of thing. Like, hey, I remember Eric Gordon being a pretty good basketball player. I can't just wait to see him play basketball. And then, of course, we repeat the process with his injuries over and over again.
Yeah.
So that was the perfect analogy.
All right. Well, thank you for the compliment. So I guess the last thing I want to say is, again, our 100th podcast. Obviously, you know, we wouldn't keep doing these with the support of all of you. You know, the comments, the feedback, has been great. You know, obviously you see the caliber of guests raising, you know, week after week, month after month. Two reasons for that. One, I think to give a little nod behind the scenes, a lot of you know him as 42, others Jason Calms, but Calmace, Calms, whatever you want to call him.
How do you not? You got his name wrong.
I was just speaking quick. Sorry about that.
Probably calculating how to drop a nuclear bomb on your head right now.
Yeah, I don't think that would take him long to calculate. He's already got my GPS position all mapped out. But seriously, behind the scenes, getting a lot of these great guests, you know, guys like Jerry V, who I know a lot of you absolutely love. That's Jason behind that. So just want to give a huge thanks to him. This podcast wouldn't be the same without him. And then to all of you, I mean, our numbers, you know, to be forthright are absolutely fantastic. And honestly, the better our numbers are, the higher caliber of guests are going to want to come on. Not that they wouldn't, you know, waste their time for 100, 200 people. But when we show them that, you know, we get in the tens of thousands of people downloading this podcast, you know, it's definitely something that gets their PR people, publicists, et cetera, excited to do the show and talk to all of you. So again, thank you so much for supporting it because of you, because of Jason, because of the work that Ryan puts in and I try to do. You know, it just keeps getting better and better. And I just I wanted to thank all of our listeners for their support and their feedback because I went back and listened to one of our first podcasts and I don't know why anybody stuck with us. It was it was a tough listen, but you did stick with us and you kept coming back. And just want to thank all of you guys.
Hey, I was putting music in the middle of the podcast in case you needed, like, that commercial music break. Everybody wants to hear that, right?
Oh, God. It was fabulous. It was like our own little American bandstand.
Right. And it's always funny listening to us talk about it back then, too. Yeah. Jeff Bowers wasn't really that bad, was he?
Did you say Jeff Bowers? Not a Mario villain.
That's true.
Yeah, I think it's really fun. I can't wait to see where we're going from here. There's going to be huge changes with the site coming soon. I think you guys are going to love that. We're going to try to work out on this podcast where it could become more interactive, where we set up a special in-the-know line to call where you could call and leave your voicemails, hopefully not too drunk after a 15-point home defeat and you guys go crazy on Bourbon Street and then call us at 3 a.m. with your podcast questions. But I think that'll be a way for you guys to engage more with us. So we're gonna continue to try to make more improvements, get all the guests that we can. But I want to thank you. And I obviously want to thank Jason Smith for coming on today. I mean, that was absolutely great. And I think there was nowhere really for him to go up, but definitely a fan favorite and a personal favorite of mine.
I agree. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Sorry, Jason, for coughing in your ear. I thought my mute button was working, but apparently it wasn't. Thanks for listening to In the Know.
Introducing Guinness Nitro Cold Brew Coffee Beer, blending the smooth, creamy nitro taste of Guinness with hints of coffee, chocolate, and caramel. Guinness Nitro Cold Brew Coffee Beer, your new favorite part of the day. Look for it where Guinness is sold. Must be 21 and over to purchase. Please enjoy responsibly. Diageo Beer Company, New York, New York.